Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the second We've Been Everywhere lecture. This will be our last lecture for the semester, but we have two more scheduled for this spring. Winston Churchill once wrote that history is written by the victors. As a student of history, however, I have found that accounts of important events made by witnesses on the ground are often much more valuable than the official accounts that come to us later. Our speaker today has one such account. Laura Delancey has been our Elizabethtown librarian since August. She obtained her MLS degree with an emphasis in digital libraries from Indiana University. This past spring, she accepted a job teaching classroom pedagogy and assessment at American University in Cairo. Once in Egypt, she found she could no longer begin her new assignment. Egypt had decided to honor her arrival by staging a revolution. For the details, please welcome Laura Delancey.
I live in Cairo, and right here where Google Maps put the A is Tahrir Square, so that was the center of the revolution. I lived 5 miles to the south, down in Mahdi, which I'll talk about a little more. It's a wealthy expat enclave full of oil money and poor expat teachers like myself. And I worked over here at the American University in Cairo. This is about 20 miles. It's in, this whole area is called New Cairo. It's basically one massive suburb. So while downtown Cairo is like full of hustle and bustle and pollution and craziness and noise, New Cairo is clean, clean streets, suburbia, McMansions, massive high-rise fancy apartment buildings. It's a totally different world over there. So as I said, I was working at the American University in Cairo. So there's a lot of American universities all over the world. They are funded in part, presumably by American money, also some local support. The president of this university is American. The faculty are part Egyptian, part international. The purpose of these universities is to offer sort of an American-style education in other parts of the world, a liberal arts education. They succeed sometimes and less so other times. I know of this particular university, it's considered the best in Egypt, but there's also a huge push by Egyptians to have it be less American. They really want to claim it as their own. They're very, very proud of it with reason, but they don't like how much American influence there is in it. It was an English-speaking university. The students here come from the wealthy elite of Cairo. These are kids who, you know, their handbag costs more than my car, and they will have jobs lined up after graduation through their parents' employment. For the most part, obviously, there's some diversity. So why did I move? Why did I take a job here? Paul, who's actually not here today, my better half, had a tenure-track job at AUC. He had been there for a year and a half before I took a job there. So he was already set up there. I got a job teaching classroom pedagogy and assessment. So I went into classrooms, I told people how they could be better teachers. I was the only American in my unit, which was, I'm going to talk about that a little more. It was very, very interesting. It was a really good opportunity to get to know actual Egyptians. That's a nice picture of minarets. Egypt is 90% Muslim and 10% mostly Coptic Christian. So the Christians are not necessarily treated very well politically. They're not explicitly discriminated against, but there is some inequality there that has flared up. If you've been following the news, there's been frequent churches lit on fire, mosques lit on fire, people throwing stones at each other, and that's still going on. It's been getting a lot worse, actually, in the last year. This is the inside of a mosque. When I went into a mosque, you always have to take off your shoes. As a woman, I had to be sure that I was wearing long sleeves and my head was covered. I did not cover my head when I was just walking around the street, but always in a mosque. It's just what you do. I just happen to like this picture. This is a bunch of air conditioning units. It's really, really hot there. In the winter, I'd wear this. In the summer, I'd also wear this because you can't wear a tank top in Egypt, but it was 110 degrees. There's great marketplaces. This is a place called Khano Khalili. These are lamps that they're made out of like metal that have holes hammered in them. They're very, very beautiful. A spice market, which is really beautiful, and you see these everywhere, and the cruel irony of it is that Egyptian food lacks any spice. Egyptian food is actually dreadfully, incredibly bland. And you'd see this, and I'm so excited. I was like, what's this? How do you cook with this? Blah, 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 blah. And I'm kind of like, oh.
So what did they eat?
Well, so the most famous Egyptian dish is something called koshari. It is lentils, pasta, chickpeas, tomato sauce, and vinegar. And you mix it all up, and it sits in your stomach like a rock for like 12 hours. They eat something called phul, which is basically boiled mashed beans. Well, I have nothing against those. I prefer to fry them as like refried beans. It would make it a little more exciting. Spinach soup is a big thing. It's just, I mean, like I said, the food is just very, very bland, which was sad. Delicious drinks, though. They drink tea all the time, amazing mint honey tea. Mostly no alcohol. The alcohol you can get in Egypt is only sold by the Christians, which is hilarious. But you have these liquor stores, and they have a picture of Jesus behind the cash register. And you can't buy alcohol a lot of places because it's like a dry community, but you can call and have it delivered to your door up until 11 at night by a nice Christian man carrying a case of very, very poor quality wine. the cruel irony there. This is just a good picture of sort of shows the contrast between living conditions and economics in Egypt. You've got these nice minivans, these nice apartments, and a couple of probably 12-year-old boys riding their horse and cart to work. You did see horses and carts in the highway all the time, which was pretty distressing sometimes. There's a lot of highway accidents there. There's cats everywhere, which is really cute, except that nobody takes care of them. And this is my favorite thing. What's the weather forecast today? It's sand. It's true, there's dust storms, and we had cracks around the windows and doors, and sand would come in. We had to sweep the house daily. If you go outside and you come home and scratch your skin, they'd be brown under your fingernails. I couldn't wear conditioner in my hair, because the slight moisture from that would attract the dust, and I'd get home and have like dusty dreadlocks. Okay, so one thing I want to talk about is the economic disparity in Egypt. So, you know, you hear people in America talking about this class warfare and the income gap between the wealthy and the poor. We ain't seen nothing here. We have people in Mahdi, where I lived. I said it was a wealthy suburb. This is a house in Mahdi. I did not live in something like this. This is my next door neighbor. My apartment is here. You have my next door neighbor. Our apartment was palatial. It had like two living rooms, two bedrooms. You know, it's just very, very big, huge, gorgeous. And our doorman, every apartment building has a doorman. It's called a bawab. He lives in this house right here. With him, his wife, and his two children, the house is probably maybe 10 feet by 20 feet. And he lives on $200 a day. Everybody who lives in the apartment building gives him a certain amount of money. Or $200 a month, I'm sorry, a month. Everybody gives him a certain amount of money. So I felt quite guilty living where I did with this man who was very, very nice. His name was Muhammad, down below me. That's his 10-year-old nephew, Muhammad Jr., I guess. He has the ring road, which is what I took to work. And here you can see the McMansions I was talking about. And it was 20 miles of this. It was actually a really depressing drive to work. The commute from here to E-Town is infinitely superior. Right next to those mansions was the houses that the people who were building these mansions lived in, which was like this. These are shacks with cardboard roofs, no running water, no electricity, and this is what, you know how construction workers in the States will live in a trailer by the building that they're working on sometimes? Well, this is the Egyptian-style trailer. So here on the rooftops, you see there's a lot of garbage. Satellite dishes are everywhere. If you zoom in on this picture, there's a family living on the rooftop. It rains only like once a year, so I guess they can get away with it. But this is pretty normal in Cairo. There's, like I said, just a huge amount of poverty. I think it's half the population lives on less than $2 a day. And obviously this came up during the revolution because people were complaining about low minimum wage, not enough jobs. There were lots of allegations of corruption against the police. They were taking bribes. And the police's defense was, well, we don't get paid enough. We have to take bribes. Like, how are we going to feed our family if we're not corrupt, basically? Another picture of downtown Cairo. There really is a lot of garbage. And it got worse after the revolution, I think, because the infrastructure is just not working as well as it should be. This is the single thing I'm asked about the most when I say that I lived in Cairo. The veil. How'd you feel about the veil? So here's the average street scene. You see, every single woman has her head covered. Now, Christian women typically don't. Some younger Muslim women don't, but pretty much everyone on the street does. But there's still a lot of variation in terms of what that looks like, what it means to wear that. So you have these two women. She looks about what your average Egyptian woman would look like, although often they would dress more colorfully. The woman on her right wears the full hijab, which covers everything. Sometimes it would also even cover the eyes. Those women are a minority in Egypt, and usually it means that their family is more religiously conservative, possibly part of the Muslim Brotherhood. But they are a minority. You know, your average Egyptian woman doesn't dress like that, but you do see it all the time. Contrast that with, you know, the students at the American University in Cairo. These are much wealthier, much better educated. They are still Muslim, but they are just much more westernized. They take vacations in Italy, all of that. So there's a big contrast there. A lot of the times when we saw footage of the revolution in the United States, we saw, you know, girls like her coming on Jon Stewart or whatever talking about it. It's important to know that those students who were involved in the revolution were a minority. I mean, the sort of the secular Western attitude, that's a minority in Egypt. Most Egyptians, even most Egyptians who were protesting, who were part of the revolution, don't have this idea that they want Egypt to be a secular Western country. They're a very visible minority, partially because they're very tech savvy. They're on Facebook, they're on Twitter. So the popular face of the revolution was much more liberal, I think, than the actual experience was. Here's me and my coworkers. So that's me in the back. Of the women who are not veiled, you have Caroline and Sandy, who are Christian. Riham is Muslim, but she is one of the more, the young, very hip ones. She wear very tight pants and very cute shirts, but always still modest, which means everything comes down there to there. I would wear t-shirts to work, because I'm 115 degrees, like, really. And they would make fun of me. I mean, they were very nice about it, but they thought it was kind of funny. One thing that was really interesting, though, is the generation gap also in terms of, especially in terms of feminism. So Dr. Aziza Alazi is my boss. She's in her 60s. Her mother was a feminist martyr in Egypt. So this woman was a feminist activist, was put under house arrest for 18 years when she finally killed herself, when my boss was a teenager. And my boss also is, you know, a very strong feminist. She believes that women should work outside the home, have careers of their own, you know, have a husband, have kids if that's your thing, but it's not necessary.
So is the modesty thing only a woman thing? Because they have their short sleeves.
Yep. So for more conservative Egyptian men, I don't have a good picture. The men will wear a long robe. So long sleeves and down to the ankle, sort of a shapeless robe. But your average Egyptian guy dresses like an American guy. And it was very striking to see on the sidewalk a guy in jeans and a t-shirt holding hands with a woman whose face is covered, who's wearing gloves, who's wearing, I mean, every inch of her is covered, and her husband is in jeans and a t-shirt. It was very striking. So, but yeah, so Aziza, like I said, she's very progressive and feminist, and she's older. The younger generation, there's been a conservative backlash in Egyptian culture, so that younger people are turning more and more to the conservatism of like their great-grandparents. So my coworkers, like Maha here and Hanet, they do work, but their husband's job always comes first when they have babies, which Maha actually just had a baby. I just found out on Facebook. They will leave their jobs to take care of their children. They might go back and work part-time, but they definitely have a very, very different attitude about it. They still consider themselves feminists. I had a lot of very interesting conversations about this. I was like, what you are calling feminism, I don't recognize. And they're like, well, but what you're calling feminism, I don't recognize. They would say, since I'm not married to my boyfriend, well, then I don't respect myself, right? And I'd say, well, but since you have to quit your job, you don't respect yourself. We had some very interesting conversations about this. Very friendly. These are all absolutely wonderful people, but just food for thought. I want you to read this, if you can. If you can't see it in the back, she's saying, everything's covered but her eyes. What a cruel, male-dominated culture. saying nothing covered but her eyes. What a cruel, male-dominated culture. This perfectly encapsulates all the conversations I had with my coworkers about this. They would ask me, well, if you wear, you know, a bathing suit, don't people look at you? You're a sex object. You're allowing yourself to be objectified. And I was like, you're trying to go swimming in a bathrobe. You can't do it. Like how does this work? It's just two very, very different perspectives. You know, I feel that I have more freedoms because I can dress however I want. They feel that by doing so, I am objectifying myself, and that they have more freedom by covering up themselves and not presenting themselves as a sex object. Interestingly, Egypt has a really high rate of sexual harassment. And we're talking 97% of all women report sexual harassment, regardless of whether or not they are wearing the veil or dressed like me. So, I don't know if it works. Speaking of, here we have a view from my balcony. We have a couple of policemen. As you can see, they're checking out the lovely lady in her yoga gear walking home. When I was harassed in Mahdi, which did happen, although since I don't speak Arabic, I never knew what exactly they were saying. You can kind of tell by the tone of voice. It was almost always by the policeman, which sort of gets into a very important point about the policeman. Everybody hates the cops in Egypt. I mean, really. They are one of the most despised sectors of society, and I would say with good reason from my own experience. So they were everywhere where I lived. They would sit in these little metal booths with their semi-automatic guns. You know, in America, cops carry like little pistols. You know, these guys have the big guns. and we liked to tell ourselves that, you know, those guns aren't really loaded. They're just for show, right? Well, then the revolution broke out, and we discovered, no, they really do have live ammunition in there. So when they're falling asleep on them at their post, it sort of, which I saw multiple times, gave a little rise to worry. So the cops are absolutely hated. Interestingly, the army and the military were, I would say, practically worshipped. The military, and one of the reasons for that is that it's, I believe military service is compulsory. And if not compulsory, very nearly. So pretty much everybody has a brother, a husband, a son, who is part of the army for a couple of years. So they really believe that the army understands them. The army is from the people. This really helped during the revolution. Now, given that they're a military dictatorship until the elections that are supposed to happen, people's attitudes to the army are rapidly changing. But their hatred for the cops remains unchanged.
Why do they hate the cops? Because they're worthless, or?
Well, because they are really corrupt. It, like, incredibly corrupt. You always have to bribe them. If you, you know, you need to get a driver's license or you get, like, pulled over for something. It's all about how much money you give them. And people don't have a lot of money, and they really resent that fact. They also, during the revolution, showed extreme brutality. So one of the things that President Mubarak and the other people are on trial for is whether or not they called for the cops to use live ammunition on the protesters. Well, I don't know if they did or not, but it did happen. That in Alexandria, Suez, and Cairo, the cops, unlike Occupy Wall Street, they're firing rubber bullets. And I don't mean to say that rubber bullets aren't serious, because I've seen their effects, and they really are, but the cops were using live ammunition. The cops also, which I'll get to soon, abandoned their posts. So during the revolution, there was not a single cop on the street. Ever. They just disappeared, they vanished. They got scared, I guess. I don't know, they ran. Or they were told to leave, we don't know. So that gives rise to a little bit of resentment. Revolution, which I know you're all the most excited about. Here's a picture of Tahrir Square, I did not take it. So I got to school, or I got to Egypt January 15th. January 25th, we have tens of thousands of people in Tahrir Square. And it was really exciting. It was great. I was so happy to be witnessing all these people, you know, showing that they wanted to overthrow President Mubarak, who had been in power for 31 years, I believe. And although he was ostensibly a president, the elections are widely known to be rigged. So I thought this was great. And then the protests happened the next day on January 26th, and I thought this was great. And then January 27th, it kind of died down. And I was like, oh, this is really too bad. You know, I really want to see some momentum going. And wow, I wish I hadn't thought that come January 28th. On Fridays is the day of prayer. So think like in a Christian culture, Sunday is the big day, everybody goes to church and blah, blah, blah. For them, it's Fridays at noon. Friday afternoon, kind of all hell broke loose. That's the big day of protest in Egypt. So even now, it's Friday afternoons is when people protest. So that Friday on January 28th, all of the policemen disappeared from their posts. They were gone, suddenly there's no cops on the street. And we start hearing all these rumors that prisoners have been let out of the local prisons, and that there are thousands of prisoners on the streets of Egypt, potentially armed, that we are to expect looting, and that really nobody knows what's going to happen. Cell phone service gets shut down entirely, and so stores start closing up shop really early. This is our local grocery store. This is probably 1 or 2 in the afternoon, and they're putting barricades up, everybody's shutting down, everybody's going home. So this is me and Paul on our porch, smoking a water pipe, listening to gunfire going, you know, all around us. A little aside about the water pipe. This is a hookah. It's about this tall. You smoke flavored tobacco in it. Neither Paul or I are smokers at all, but we did find that the hookah was pretty enjoyable. The hookah is huge in Egyptian society. Nobody goes to the bar because they don't drink. There's not really coffee shops. But there's tea houses where people smoke hookah just everywhere. They're all over the sidewalk. And it's only men who get to do this. Women don't really. But sometimes like the people who live down below us and the guards would see that I was up there with a hookah. And I thought that was quite weird. Because it's definitely not a feminine pastime. So what had happened immediately before this picture is we were told that we should stay inside because there's going to be looting, nobody knows what's going to happen. And Paul, I was like, okay, let's stay inside, sounds like a good idea. Paul's like, no, I want to check it out and see what's going on outside. And we started fighting, I was like, no, please don't. He said, no, I'm going to go. I said, okay, I'm going to go with you, but I'm like, he says, okay. He's like, if I see a guy with a gun, I'll go back inside, right? I said, okay. So we go outside, and our neighbor, where are you guys going? And he's Egyptian. I can't do an Egyptian accent. He's like, where are you going? Paul's like, oh, we're going to go outside. He goes, no, you can't do that. Paul's like, no, we're just going to check it out. The guy goes, do you have a gun? We're like, no. The guy pulls up his shirt, and he's got a gun down his pants. And he says, you can't go outside unless you have a gun. So we went back inside, and I totally had an I told you so moment. I was like, a guy with a gun told us to stay in, we gotta do it. this afternoon turned into what for me is probably the scariest night of my life to date, because there was constant gunfire starting in the afternoon and going into the following morning. Just every few minutes you would hear, sometimes it sounded like, you know, automatic fire, sometimes it was these big booms. I didn't know what they were. We had no idea. Obviously, we don't have phones at this point. We don't have internet at this point because the government shut all communications down. So I was quaking in my boots all night. Paul slept like a baby. because we were afraid there was going to be looters, our doorman and his friends built these awesomely high-tech barricades that you see there that are fallen logs in other parts of the neighborhood. It was overturned police stalls. It was overturned telephone poles, anything to block off the neighborhood. There were checkpoints. If you were white, you could get through a checkpoint, but if they're like, you're a foreigner, whatever you're doing. But if you're Egyptian, you were having to show ID to even get into the neighborhood. They formed bands of about, you know, 5 to 10 men armed with machetes, armed with clubs, armed with God knows what. Guns, by the way, are illegal in Egypt. Obviously, this didn't stop anyone. And they stayed up all night patrolling the neighborhood, shouting if they saw somebody who didn't belong there, and driving them out. There we have, that's our doorman, Muhammad. That's his nephew, about 10 years old, Muhammad, also. This 10-year-old boy had a stick as big as he was, and he was sitting, standing guard at one end of the street. And if he saw anything, he'd run and tell the other people, you know, that they needed to come check it out. I, to be perfectly honest, stayed inside and was quite scared. I did not join the neighborhood watch patrols. The next day dawned bright and clear, and we decided to go for a walk to see if there had been any looting. And in fact, in Mahdi, there was very, very little looting. There was a couple of grocery stores that got looted. Only two people in Mahdi were killed. They were killed trying to rob a bank. So Mahdi ended up actually being fairly safe that night. But we did see tanks. There's another tank. And they got really mad at me when I tried to take their picture. So I was like hiding behind Paul. Paul's standing there. I'm like trying to peer around and take the pictures. A burned out cop van, like I said, a lot of animosity towards the cops who had abandoned their posts, so they torched the cop van. This was about half a mile from my house. So I evacuated and went to Istanbul. There was a voluntary evacuation, which I had never done one before. All you do is you show up at the airport, you get in line, they don't tell you where you're gonna go. So you have no idea. You sign a piece of paper that says, I promise to pay for this ticket for an undisclosed amount at some undisclosed future date. And they put you on an airplane. My airplane landed in Istanbul, which is beautiful. I had good fish sandwiches. I stayed there for about a week before my money ran out, and I returned to Cairo, although the revolution was still going on. I figured I wasn't ready to go home. My boss wanted me back at work, so I went back.
Did you hear about the voluntary, was communication back on the next day, or?
No, interestingly, actually, one thing that caused a lot of resentment amongst AUC faculty is that we heard nothing from the university for a week after the revolution started. So the revolution is going, we're not going to work, and we hear not a peep from the administration or anybody telling us, like, what the hell are we supposed to be doing? I heard about this through actually somebody who worked at the library there, through somebody else who worked at the State Department. It was all word of mouth.
Wow.
And to get to the airport, we all piled into a van, had to drive the wrong way down the highway because the roads were blocked, and, went to Istanbul. While I was in Istanbul, meanwhile, back at the ranch, that's supposed to symbolize the ranch, we have a government building that was torched in downtown Tahrir. And we had the day with the highest casualties, which was February 2nd, the day that Mubarak hired a bunch of thugs, and I mean this literally, from Aswan, bust them up, busloads of these guys armed with like 2x4s with nails stuck through them, bust them up to Tahrir Square, put them on camelback, I kid you not, where they ran through the square just sort of laying about them with their weapons. The violence carried on into the night. They ran out of weapons. They were ripping up the cobblestones from Tahrir Square and using them to hurl at each other. Paul went for a walk this day just in our neighborhood. He saw people making Molotov cocktails, which if you don't know what that is, it's like a bottle full of alcohol with a fuse, a homemade bomb. So this day, the total revolution had a death toll of about 800. This revolution, this day probably had half that. So I came back to Cairo, even though the revolution was still going on. And this sort of encapsulates why I didn't watch the news even when I was back there. Because finally we did get TV, although we didn't have regular for a while. Internet did come back on, as did phones. And so you'd check the New York Times, you'd check the BBC, and they'd be like, oh my God, there's protests in Cairo. And be like, yeah, but there's smoke coming from downtown and I want to know what's causing that. And of course it would take them 12 hours to actually get around to have that be the news story. What just happened? Okay. I used Al Jazeera a lot, which before I moved to Egypt, it never occurred to me to read Al Jazeera, but Al Jazeera is sort of like the New York Times of the Middle East. It was by far some of the best coverage of the revolution. I also had lots of fun Googling English language Egyptian newspapers to get some stuff, because again, the New York Times and the BBC, they're only gonna show, what's the top headline. And because I was actually living there, I usually wanted to know a little bit more about that. The thing I used the most was Twitter. I am not a Twitter person, I do not like Twitter, but the very cool thing about it is that it's instantaneous. And so the way to follow the revolution on Twitter, even now, is hashtag Jan25. That's sort of the rallying cry of the revolution, it's the January 25th revolution. So I could Google that and find out everything people were saying about what was happening right now. And so I could find out that, the bridge into Zamalek is closed, or there's been fighting in this area, or if I heard gunshots in Mahdi, I could just type in gunfire, Mahdi, and see that somebody else is saying, oh yeah, in fact, there's fighting going on in this area. This guy is, I have no idea who he actually is, but he was the most prolific Twitter and social media activist of the Egyptian revolution. It says, micro celebrity, blogger, activist, new media, douchebag, pain in the ass, sand monkey. He's very, very famous amongst the young people of the revolution in Egypt, and he was right there in the middle of everything and tweeting about it. When the internet was cut down, he would send text messages to his friends in the States, and they would post his tweets so that you could still follow him. But I don't know who he is, but he was like my favorite person for that week. So the revolution finally ended, but I think that that is not an accurate way to look at it. President Mubarak stepped down, which is fantastic and is great. But there's still protests every Friday in Cairo, as far as I know. There were still, the whole time I was living there. There were some days that we wouldn't go downtown because we heard that there was protests. Okay, some days that we did go downtown. And I went to a couple of the protests and just to check them out. People were usually pretty friendly. But there still have been explosions of people using rubber bullets and tear gas. We have a friend, Thumba Lewis, who's a photojournalist, and we went to have a drink with him one night and had a big red spot in the middle of his forehead from being hit with a rubber bullet round just a couple hours before. Even though the revolution was over, there were still tanks everywhere. This is my drive to work. There were just tank checkpoints very regularly. We also lived under curfew, so during the revolution, curfew at one point was like 3 in the afternoon. It got pushed back till 6 in the evening, 9, midnight. By the time I left Cairo, there was still a curfew, I believe, from midnight till 6 in the morning. That was ostensibly to keep peace, but I think, in fact, sort of like you've seen actually with the Occupy Wall Street movement, is that curfews are used as an excuse to arrest people who you don't want to have out there. You know, if they're on public property, they can stay there, but if you're like, well, you're violating curfew, well, then they can haul them in. So they're using this regularly to clear Tahrir Square for protesters. There was a huge resurgence of patriotism after the revolution. Everybody was just so proud to be Egyptian and so proud of what they had accomplished. And in a lot of ways, that was really wonderful, and I really think that they deserve it. You'd see posters saying, you know, the Egyptians and the Tunisians deserve the Nobel Peace Prize. Like, these revolutions went off, honestly, relatively peacefully. We have Syria, which has a death toll of now over 3,200. One of the things they really congratulated themselves on was how low the death toll was and how little violence there was. And I have to say, I really just think they got really lucky. The military, as I was saying earlier, everybody loved the military. The military never turned on the people. The military protected the people, even. The riot police were using live ammunition and killing people. The military never did that. It would have taken just one high-ranking military guy. You know, just if he had made one different decision, the whole thing would have looked really different. If the military had ever turned on the people, I don't think this revolution would have succeeded. I mean, only now the military and General Tantawi are in power, and they were first supposed to have elections in September. Those have been pushed back, I believe, to November. Nobody really knows what's going to happen. So to say that the revolution is over, I think, is a real misnomer, because they've gone essentially from one dictatorship to another. More flags, you see these flags everywhere, people have this face paint on. More tanks. I told you there'd be lots of pictures of tanks. I had like a whole tank photo album. It was a novelty for me. And then I started my job here, and I was like making a joke. I was like, well, at least I won't see any tanks, right? And they're like, well, you know you work at Fort Knox too, right? Why? So here's a good question that's happening now in Egypt is, what's going to happen next? But one of the most interesting things is it's not this clear cut. You know, this is not necessarily an either-or proposition. A lot of times the United States, when we talk about Egyptian politics, we say, well, either it's going to be secular and democratic or it's going to be the Muslim Brotherhood. But it's a lot more complicated than that. I mean, if you think in American politics, we're a democracy of sorts in some way, right? But we still have a lot of people who would only elect a religious president and who strongly believe that religion has a place in our laws. We have a lot of people who don't believe that. Well, it's the same thing in Egypt. It might go to the Muslim Brotherhood, but it might not. But there is obviously going to be somehow have to figure out what the intersection of religion and politics is going to be in the future. And it's not at all clear where that's going to go. The Muslim Brotherhood, as an aside, was outlawed under Mubarak, but since Mubarak fell, they have definitely come back, although cautiously. But they are the best organized political party. Because really, under Mubarak, you didn't have any other political parties. So once Mubarak falls, everybody's just sort of scrambling to get together some semblance of a political ideology. They haven't had a lot of time to put this together. So it's really unclear where it's going to go. This is a picture from my friend Thumba Lewis of Mubarak on trial. Mubarak has been unwell. I guess it was very stressful to have to fall after a revolution. I don't feel bad for him at all. But so here he's on trial for whether or not he told his minions, I guess, to fire on the protesters. And he says he didn't, and somebody else says he did. Obviously, the order was given at some point because it happened, but we don't know who gave that order. And 5 minutes early, I'm wrapping up with my parting picture. This was actually our last night in Cairo. We walked by the Nile and took a beautiful picture of the sunset. So that's about it.
Do we have any questions?
Yeah.
John. You said that one of your neighbors had a gun.
Yeah.
And you said it was illegal.
Yep.
How prevalent was that?
I don't know the statistics on that. Definitely after the revolution, we read newspaper stories about there's guns everywhere now after the revolution. But we also read a lot of stories that were, frankly, completely over the top and really exaggerated the problem. So some people would say that there's been a huge rise in gun violence. Others say there's not. I don't know how common it is because I never read a statistic about it, and he was the only person I ever saw say, hey, look at my gun. So I don't know. Do you happen to know? Paul? Okay. Any other questions? Yeah.
Well, while you were in Cairo, did you have a chance to get out to Alexandria, or were you restricted in the...
So I never went to the Library of Alexandria. as a librarian, this is a little shameful. I didn't go, the first time I visited Cairo, I didn't go because instead I went scuba diving in Dahab. The second time when I was living in Cairo, I didn't go because actually travel to Alexandria by land was considered quite dangerous. It's the desert road that goes out there. And there were, and again, some of these stories are probably really exaggerated, but we were issued warnings not to travel overland to these places because of carjackings or what have you. So I did not go.
Is the tourist business, beginning to revive, or is it dead in the water?
It's pretty dead. So tourism is a huge section of Egypt's economy, and obviously this did really bad things to the tourist industry. And it's still not picking up. Part of that is that there's continued instability. There's still protests. There's still a lot of sectarian clashes. So although the revolution is over, people aren't feeling like it's safe to go back. And so the economy is having a really hard time recovering. Yeah.
At what point did you decide to leave Egypt entirely and come back to the U.S.? Was it before the revolution started? Because it sounds like there were lifestyle issues that you had even before.
No,
that.
It wasn't. When I moved to Egypt, our plan was that we would probably be sticking around there for a while. And then Paul applied for a job here, and shortly after, a job came open that I also applied for. So once we both found out that we had jobs lined up, we decided it was a good time to leave. And I have to say, I'm glad I left because if, for example, the Muslim Brotherhood were to take power, I think Egypt would be a far less pleasant place to be a woman living there. So it wasn't the revolution that made us leave. It was actually this kind of happenstance that these other jobs came up. So, and we weren't feeling super attached to it. Yeah.
Since everyone hates the police, is there ever a call to have the police come for domestic violence or robbery or anything?
That's a really good question.
Do they ever call them?
I wouldn't even know how to call the police in Egypt. I mean, I'm sure there might be a phone number, but...
not a 911 equivalent.
Right, but I have never heard of anybody calling that. During the revolution, they torched the police station a couple times, so I guess they weren't planning on on relying on them.
Yeah.
My feeling is that a lot of local violence is just taken care of locally. So, and I don't know about domestic violence.
In this country, a lot of military will come back. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they'll go into law enforcement in some fashion or other.
Right.
And I guess that's not the case in
Egypt. I don't get the feeling that that's the case. I mean, honestly, some people do sign up to be policemen because they do
exist.
But they, like I said, they're not respected.
Yeah.
It's not a good career move.
Yeah.
I even heard about some families of policemen being harassed during the revolution because they had family members who were.
Yeah. Thank you.
Did you have trouble getting food, especially with all the stores shutting down early? Did you ever find yourself?
We didn't, actually. The day that the stores shut down, everybody was kind of freaking out and stockpiling food. I think I bought a lot of pasta. But we did not have trouble getting food in our neighborhood. I did hear that there were food shortages near downtown because everything was just closed down. But there has not been at any point actually during this widespread food shortage. So, yeah.
Were the utilities ever shut off, like gas or
no.
water? Did they use gas over there?
Yeah, we use gas stoves. Again, so phones and internet were shut down, and we heard rumors that other utilities were going to be shut down. Actually, right before I went to Istanbul, that was one of the things that made me really think I should get out of there. But no, they never did get shut off. No. So, yeah.
Do you speak Arabic?
I do not. I do not speak any Arabic. I was starting to learn. I had some like little tapes that I was listening to. But once we realized that we were going to be leaving, I didn't honestly spend that much time on it. And all of my coworkers spoke English because it was the American University. And they were pretty good about speaking English around me, although sometimes it'd break off.
Was it hard to get around when you didn't speak their language? Or does mm-hmm. a large percentage of the population know English?
No. So you can take the subway. You don't really need to know English for that because a lot of the signs are written both in Arabic and in English. The cab drivers speak varying levels of English. So sometimes you get a cab driver who is really excited and really chatty and want to talk to you. Sometimes you get a cab driver who didn't speak a word of English. He might tell you that he did and tell you that he knew where you were going, but he would in fact not. There were around my neighborhood, I knew my way around enough that I could take a cab and know if he was going the wrong way. But I did have one cab driver, actually the first day that I went by myself to work, I took a cab instead of the bus. And I said, you know, American University, New Cairo. He said, yes. And then he goes, where are we going? And I freaked out. I opened the door. I'm trying to climb out of the cab while it's moving. He won't let me. He keeps going. And he's having to stop and ask for directions everywhere because he did not, in fact, have any idea what I was talking about. So, yes.
So is this election, what are your feelings on that? Is it going to be Democratic or what do you think is going to happen?
I actually don't know. It's been postponed a couple times. And I'm not entirely sure why. It is supposed to be Democratic.
So it's kind of a dictatorship by the military right now?
The military is definitely running the show right now. And previous elections in Egypt were ostensibly Democratic, and in fact, it is mandatory to vote. Everybody has to vote, but then the results are not counted fairly. So obviously the hope is that that doesn't continue to happen. But I don't really know. I just don't know what safeguards they're putting in place.
Yeah.
And one of the big issues also is just education of the people. So there was a referendum on the Constitution back in, I think, March. And people could either vote to rewrite the Constitution or to keep it with a couple changes. And a lot of the people I work with really wanted them to make major changes to the Constitution. But a lot of people, just they're not well enough educated to understand the difference between the two positions. I don't know what the illiteracy rate in Egypt is. There is mandatory schooling, but a lot of people are pulled out for work reasons and other reasons. So it's just really hard to get people educated about the issues, just like in America, honestly. I mean, I think a lot of people aren't educated about the issues, and we just vote how our parents do or, you know, whatever. And the same issue is definitely true in Egypt.
Are they taxed quite a bit in Egypt? Like a person's paycheck,
right.
Percentage would come out for government?
I actually don't know offhand. I mean, I think a lot of people are probably paid under the table, in which case that wouldn't be an issue, but I don't know for official government pay what percentage is taxed. Any other questions? All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
There's your housekeeping. You've got a couple of door prizes.
All right, after your drawing, door prizes. How many am I drawing? Okay. Paula Owens.
Woohoo!
Brian Carson.
Wow.
Okay. Dean is walking around with our sign-in book. If you came late or she hasn't gotten to you yet, please see her before you leave. Also, we still have refreshments in the back, and I look forward to seeing all of you in February when Christopher is going to talk about growing up in Peru. So, thank you all very much for coming.